Gavin hadn't even fully got out of his father's apartment when he saw trouble coming. His mother's apartments were right beside his father's, and there was no way he could leave without passing in front of her doors. And her doors were open.
Every time. Every burning time.
If his father's windows hadn't all been bolted shut and covered with layers of fabric, Gavin would have jumped out of a window. Nonetheless, Gavin turned in as he went past his mother's open doors. The room slave was a young Tyrian girl, judging from her dark eyes and hair and copi-colored skin. Gavin motioned to her, as he passed, that she should close the doors behind him. His mother had a talent for training slaves. Even a girl barely in her teens like this one would wait attentively and respond to the smallest signal. Of course, Gavin wasn't so much different, was he?
Mother.
His mother stood as he came close. Felia Guile was a handsome woman in her early 50s. She had been a cousin of the Atashian royal family, and in her youth, the Atashian noble families rarely married foreigners. Andros Guile, of course, had been a special case. He always was. She had the classic striking Atashian pairing of olive skin and cornflower blue eyes, though her blue eyes bore a wide halo of dull orange around the iris. She had been an orange drafter, though she wasn't greatly talented. Andros would never have married a woman who couldn't draft. Slim despite her age, Felia was regal, fashionable, comfortable in herself, commanding without being domineering, beautiful and warm. He had no idea how she could stand being married to his father. She flicked two fingers of her left hand, dismissing the room slave without taking her eyes off Gavin.
My son, so I hear a rumor that you have a nephew.
That's correct.
A natural son.
That's right. He's a good young man. His name's Kip.
15 years old.
She didn't say.
So you cheated on your fiancé, whom I've been urging you to marry for the last 16 years.
Felia loved Karis. Andros Guile had been dead set against Gavin marrying a woman whose family had nothing, like Karis's, after the war. It was one of the few areas where Gavin's mother had continued to defy his father. Usually, when they disagreed, she would let her objections be known with force and eloquence, and then concede to whatever Andros decided. Not a few times, Gavin had seen Andros change his mind after his mother so artfully surrendered. The disagreement over Karis White Oak, however, had involved screaming, shattered porcelain, and tears. Gavin thought sometimes that if he hadn't been present during that fight, Andros would have given in. But the man couldn't lose face in front of anyone, much less his boundary-pushing son.
He is.
So, is his existence as much of a surprise to you as it is to everyone else, or more?
A shiver shot down Gavin's spine. His mother was no fool. She was as careful to guard against eavesdroppers as anyone, but she had ways of getting to exactly what she meant. After Sundered Rock, when Gavin had staggered alone out of the magical conflagration, wearing his brother's clothing and his brother's crown and his brother's scars under layers of soot and blood, everyone else had taken him to be Gavin unquestioningly. Despite the age difference, the brothers had been mistaken for twins dozens of times, and their mannerisms were uncannily similar. And Gavin had been careful to emulate his brother's idiosyncrasies of vocabulary and expression. Any differences that had emerged after the war ended had been written off as Gavin having been changed by having to kill his own brother. But Gavin woke the morning of his first night back at the Chromeria to find his mother sitting on the foot of his bed. Her eyes were red and puffy from weeping, though her cheeks were dry. She'd been careful to do her weeping before he woke.
Did you think I wouldn't know my own boy? You're the blood of my blood. Did you think you could deceive even me?
I didn't think it would work this long, Mother. I expected any of 100 people to see through this farce. But what else can I do?
I understand why you've done what you've done. I just had braced myself against your death, not your brother's. And now to see you... It's like having to choose which of my remaining sons I'd prefer to die.
No one's asking that of you.
Just tell me this. Is Gavin dead?
Yes. I didn't want... He gave me... I'm sorry.
Her eyes had streamed tears, but she ignored them.
What do you need, Dazen? I've lost both of your brothers. I swear to Orholam, I won't lose you.
Tell them I'm convalescing. Tell them the battle nearly killed me. When the time is right, tell them it changed me. But don't make me look weak.
And so she'd become his only true ally in the Chromeria. And after she left, he'd barred the door and opened the chest where his drugged brother lay, not a foot from where their mother had stood. He studied the unconscious figure minutely, and then himself in a mirror. Taking note of every difference, he set to work. His brother's hair had a cowlick that stuck out whenever he cut it short. The new Gavin would have to wear his hair long, so no one noticed this disparity. Gavin was a little shorter than Dazen, and had liked to wear boots with more heel. The new Gavin would wear flatter shoes. He began writing lists of his brother's mannerisms, the way Gavin liked to pop his neck to the left and right. Damn it, Dazen didn't even know how to pop his neck. Gavin liked to shave every day, even twice a day to keep his face smooth. Dazen had shaved a few times a week, finding it too much bother. Gavin always wore a particular scent. Dazen had never bothered. He'd have to send a servant to fetch it. Gavin cared about his clothing and made sure he was at the forefront of every trend. Dazen didn't even know how he did that. Had Gavin plucked his eyebrows? Dear Orholum. Other changes were harder to make. Dazen had a mole on the inside of one elbow. Grimacing, he sliced it off. It would become a little scar. No one would notice. His mother helped, coming every day, handkerchief in hand for her silent tears, but back, ramrod straight. She pointed out quirks Dazen never would have remembered, like the way his brother stood when he was thinking, and what foods Gavin loved and what he hated. But the biggest reason for his success had been the real Gavin himself. Gavin had painted Dazen as a false prism. He'd sworn that Dazen deceived his retainers with parlor tricks that would never convince anyone who wasn't criminal or insane, or who stood to benefit by standing with a false prism. Everyone knew there was only ever one prism every generation, so they'd believed the old Gavin implicitly. So from their first glance at Dazen's prismatic eyes, they knew he was Gavin. Those who knew better, who knew that Dazen had never needed parlor tricks, who knew he was as much a prism as Gavin, in other words, Dazen's closest retainers and friends, had been scattered to the four winds after the Battle of Sundered Rock. He'd betrayed them. And if it was a betrayal for the greater good, it still kept him up nights to know that Elysian pirates were selling his people for slaves in 100 ports. He drew up his first list of 7 great purposes, and he did what he could. And through it all, his mother had saved him 12 times. She deserved the truth.
More.
It was more of a surprise to him than to anyone that he had a son. He and his men had been living in caves and on the run, and even if he'd had the energy for entertaining some of the camp followers, he'd been heartsick over Karis's engagement to Gavin. Dazen hadn't slept with anyone during the war.
So you've adopted your brother's natural son. Why?
Because I know what it's like to be alone.
You don't give Karis enough credit.
What's she got to do with anything?
She didn't take it well.
You might say that.
What are you going to do if your father refuses to recognize the boy?
He's not moving me on this, Mother. I don't do very many things that are right. He's not taking this one away.
Did it make your list of 7 purposes this time? Defying him?
My list only has things that are possible.
So it's harder than stopping the blood war? Harder than destroying the pirate lords?
Twice. And yes.
You get that from him, you know.
What?
Your father always made lists. Goals to check off. Marry a girl from the right family by 25. Join the Spectrum by 40. He made it by 35. And so on. Of course, he never had to organize his life in 7-year blocks.
Did he never want to be Prism himself?
Prisms usually only last 7 years.
Not long enough for my father. I see. He wanted more sons and daughters, didn't he?
More tools. More weapons, in case more went bad.
I want to go home, Gavin. I've wanted to join the freeing for years. I'm so tired.
For a moment, Gavin couldn't breathe. His mother was the very quintessence of life. Beauty, energy, cleverness, good nature. To hear her speak as if she were broken down, as if she wanted to quit, was like a blow to the stomach.
Of course, your father will never allow it. But whether he allows it or not, sometime in these next 5 years, I'm joining. I've buried 2 sons. I will not bury you.
So she was just giving him warning, giving him time to prepare. Dear Orholm, he didn't even want to think about it. His mother had been his only companion, his best advisor, the one person who sniffed out threats from leagues away and loved him no matter what.
So what were your 7 purposes? Accomplished any of them yet?
I learned to fly. Took me most of the last year.
That could prove handy. You're serious.
I'll have to take you for a ride. A flight? Sometime. You'll love it.
And you think the idea of that is a good enough distraction to sidetrack me from getting the rest of your goals out of you?
Absolutely. I learned from the best.
Very well. Now get out of here. And son, be careful. You know how your father is when someone won't do what he wills.
Kip woke with a dead arm from a dream about his mother holding his head in her lap. It wasn't a dream. It was half memory. He'd been young. His mother was running her fingers through his hair, her eyes red, swollen. Red eyes usually meant she'd been smoking haze, but this morning she didn't smell of smoke or alcohol.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I've quit. It's going to be different from now on. I promise.
He cracked open one sleep snot encrusted eye. He rolled over. He'd slept on the ground? On a carpet? Oh, as the blood slowly flooded back into his arm, it started hurting. He rubbed it until feeling returned. Where was he? Oh, Liv's room. It was barely dawn. Sitting up, Kip saw a woman coming in the room. Liv must have slept elsewhere. The covers of the bed weren't even disturbed.
Good morning, Kip.
She was a dark woman, with heavy eyebrows, frizzy hair, and a flamboyant gold scarf around her neck. She was thick, hugely tall, with great heavy shoulders and a bold patterned green dress draped over her, like a sheet over a galleas.
It's dawn, and it's time for your first lesson. I'm Mistress Hallel.
You're my magister?
Oh, yes. And you'll remember today's lesson for the rest of your life. Get up, Kip.
Kip stood. She walked past him and opened a door to a small balcony outside Liv's room.
Come quickly. You need to see this before the sun is fully over the horizon.
Hair squashed, mouthful of cotton, breath foul, arm throbbing, Kip licked his dry lips and stepped past Mistress Hallel. Her eyes were dark and intense, so dark that he couldn't even tell what color of a drafter she was.
Weird. Here I'm supposed to see minute differentiation in colors undetectable to most people, and I couldn't even see the color in her irises.
He stepped onto the pure yellow Luxon balcony. Aside from streaks of water or dirt, the entire thing was eerily clear. Despite his experience yesterday, learning that the yellow was one of the strongest materials known, Kip tested his weight on the balcony gingerly. It was, of course, solid. Due to the way the towers all leaned out, as if blossoming, if Kip fell from here, he'd smash on the rock several hundred feet below, just shy of the water. It was even worse for the floors above them, which leaned even farther out. He tried to pay attention to the rising sun.
We don't have all day, Kip!
Kip turned as she stepped out onto the balcony with him. At first he thought she was tripping because she lunged forward so suddenly. He moved toward her to catch her. If there was one good thing about being fat, it was that he could stop big weights. But Mistress Hallel extended both of her hands like battering rams. They crushed together in an awkward hug.
I've got you! Don't worry, you're not going to...
Get off me!
Mistress Hallel was already bending over. The woman's big, meaty hands slapped on Kip's right and left legs. His move to the side made her left hand slip off his right leg, though. Then, she lifted.
What are you doing?
Dead concentration, complete lack of emotion. She pushed forward hard into Kip, lifting. He put it all together far too slowly. Kip's hand slapped against the edge of the balcony behind him. With only one leg in her hands, Mistress Hallel lifted sharply. She was so strong that Kip's weight was no problem for her. Mistress Hallel brought one hand off Kip's left leg, seeking a grip anywhere on his round body. Kip wriggled like a fish, pushing off the balcony, trying to push himself back into the tower. She pinned him against the corner of the balcony with her own substantial weight and drew back her left hand to punch him. Her fist descended and landed a glancing blow, but Kip fell. She lost her hold as he went turtle, barely keeping a grip on his pant leg.
Oh, damn!
She tried to lift him by that alone. His pants ripped, and then slipped off his waist. They tangled around his knees, but however his baggy pants hampered his movements, they did nothing to help the assassin lift him either.
Take your death like a man!
Kip bit her ankle. The assassin fell on top of him. She landed with her head toward his feet. She trapped one of Kip's legs in one iron hand. Then she punched his thigh. Then she grabbed his other leg. No amount of thrashing could break her grip. She pummeled his other leg, and it too went dead. She pushed herself up and punched him in the groin. Her weight shifted, crushing him again. She had one of his ankles in each of her hands, and she lifted him easily. She was going to toss him over the balcony. There was nothing he could do to stop it. Suddenly, Kip saw a thin beam of superviolet Luxon stick to the assassin's head.
Stop it! Drop him now!
Damn it!
The assassin turned toward Liv, just as a yellow Luxon ball blasted from her hands and zipped along the superviolet line. Mistress Hellel staggered backward. She was so tall that the rail of the balcony caught her below the waist. She hit it hard and tottered. Her meaty hands slapped onto the rail as she went on tiptoe, feet seeking purchase. Kip, lying on the ground, slid a hand under her foot and lifted. The assassin felt herself going over the edge. She fell and caught herself on the rail of the balcony. Through the clear yellow of the balcony, she swung face to face with Kip. Each balcony had a small gap for rainwater to sluice off so it wouldn't fill with water, and the big woman's face was barely a foot from Kip's own. Kip looked at her. He knew how this ended. Some skinny woman might be able to pull her weight up, but not a woman this size. Kip was strong. He could lift heavier things than Sanson or even Ram. But when you were really big, heaving your entire weight over a ledge was impossible. And this woman was much bigger than he was. For one terrifying moment, Kip thought he was wrong. Her elbows bent and her body lifted. She swung one heavy leg to the side, trying to reach it high enough to reach the rain gap in the balcony. Then her strength gave out, and she swung back to vertical.
Light cannot be chained, little guile! A knot blind you! Mock smite you to the 10th generation! Belphegor blight your sons! Atirot spit on your mother's grave! Ferilux corrupt your father's...
Her body slammed into a sharp boulder, not 5 paces from the crashing waves of the Cerulean Sea. And her body actually burst asunder, a piece, a leg, shearing off and flying to splash into the water as the rest of her crunched in one long, bloody smudge. It didn't seem real. Part of Kip knew that could have been him. Maybe should have been him.
Kip, we killed her.
Kip was more aware that his balls were aching, and he was pretty much naked in front of the only girl he knew, that he was fat and gross and should cover himself immediately. He'd barely hiked up his pants by the time Liv lurched to the balcony rail. Kip hated throwing up. He hated himself throwing up, and he hated other people throwing up. But worst, he discovered, as the wind blew across the yellow tower and carried mist through the rain gap, Kip hated being thrown up on.
Oh no.
Liv looked from him to his crotch where his pants were torn, and then to the rock so far below.
I can't believe. What?
You know, I'm glad things aren't awkward between us.
It was like part of him couldn't help being totally inappropriate. He just killed someone. And he was so terrified and pained and embarrassed and mortified and thankful to be alive, and he didn't even know what all else, he couldn't help himself. Liv's mouth twitched up for half a moment, and then she leaned back over the rail.
Always something to say, never the right thing. Well done, Kip.
Midsummer's coming. Sunday.
Gavin stood in front of the white on the top of the Chromeria. Together, they were waiting for the sun to rise. Midsummer, as far as Gavin was concerned, was always coming.
I've started preparations for the freeing. Do you think your father will commune this year?
Not this year, not ever.
It's not natural. I used to marvel at his self-control, you know. Living in that awful room, keeping his mind sharp, keeping the nightmares at bay.
Nightmares have to keep him at bay.
I live half in darkness, Gavin. That's how it feels to live without drafting. But to live fully in darkness? Is that not a denial of Orholm himself? They love the darkness, for their deeds are dark, and the light shames them.
I leave the state of my father's soul to my father. Are we not to honor our fathers, rendering obedience unto the authority the father of all has entrusted to them?
You're not just a son, Gavin, you're the prism. You should honor Orholm by practicing the authority he's given you, not just the power.
Maybe it's time for you to be freed.
Gavin had these conversations at least once a year. He was sick of it. The White asked after his father. His father suggested the White go first. Both pressured him to pressure the other. The White held her hands out, palms up.
If you command it, my prism, I will join the freeing. Gladly.
Her words stopped him cold.
I also obey. It might surprise you to learn it, Gavin, but I drew the straw to become the White before I began to understand what it was to even be a drafter, much less a color, much less the White. But perhaps it is not a lesson that can be taught, only learned.
What are you talking about?
Do you know why faith is harder for us, my Lord Prism?
Because we know Orholm sleeps 100 years for every day he wakes?
Because we know ourselves. Because others obey us as though we were gods, and we know we're not. We see the fragility of our own power, and through it we see the fragility of every other link. What if the Spectrum suddenly refused my orders? Not hard to imagine when you consider the scheming and lust for power it takes to become a color. What if a general suddenly refuses his satrap's orders? What if a son refuses his father's orders? What if that first link in the great chain of being, Orholm himself, is as empty as every other link before him? Seeing the weakness of each link, we think the great chain itself is fragile. Surely at any moment it will burst if we don't do everything in our power to hold it together.
Gavin had never really universalized the thought as she was doing, but he always thought his whole life was like that. His deceptions, his authority, his imprisoned brother, his relationships. A chain of wet paper, drooping under its own sodden weight. A chain to which he added new weight every day.
Here's what I've learned. Orholm doesn't need me. Oh, I can do good work for him, work that pleases him. And if I foul it, others will suffer. You see, what I do still matters, but not in the end. Orholm's will prevails. So I think I still have work to do. I see unfinished business everywhere I look. But if you tell me that I should be freed this Midsummer's, I will do so gladly. Not because I have faith in you, Gavin, though I do more than you know, but because I have faith in Orholm.
That was very metaphysical. Can we talk about the freeing now?
Here's the thing, Gavin. You remember everything. I know you do. You think I'm crazy now, but you'll remember this, and someday it might make a difference. And with that, I can be content.
Madwoman or saint? But then, Gavin didn't think there was any difference.
I'm going to Garriston.
She folded her hands in her lap and turned toward the rising light.
Let me explain.
Then he did, ignoring the beauty of the sunrise. 10 minutes later, he was almost finished when the White raised a finger.
Do you ever watch for the green flash?
Sometimes.
He knew people who swore they'd seen it, though no one could explain what it was or why it happened, and he knew others who swore it was a myth.
I think of it as Orholm's wink.
You've seen it?
Twice. The first time, 59 years ago now? No, 60. It was the night I met Albert. I was at a party, quite disgusted with the drunk young gentleman who'd escorted me there and most certainly wasn't going to be escorting me home. I went outside to get some air, watched the sun set, saw the green flash, and was so excited I jumped. Unfortunately, this very tall fellow was leaning over me to grab his wine glass that he'd left on the balcony, and I broke his nose with the back of my hand.
You met Ulbert Rathcore by breaking his nose?
The woman he was escorting that night was none too pleased. She was beautiful, graceful, prettier than I was by half, and somehow she couldn't compete with a little clumsy me. Though I can't imagine she would have been happy if she'd married Albert. Your grandmother didn't forgive me for 2 years.
My grandmother?
If I hadn't seen the green flash at that instant, your grandmother would have married Albert, and you wouldn't be here now, Gavin. See? You never know what you'll learn when you let old women prattle.
Gavin was left speechless.
You can go to Garriston, of course, Gavin, but no one else can perform the freeing. And it can be done at no other time. So there's only one option. I'll send all those to be freed to Garriston. I'll have to send our fastest ships to intercept there so they can arrive in time.
We're talking about war.
And?
What do you mean, and? I'm not going to have time to throw parties and set off fireworks and give speeches.
The list I have so far is only perhaps 150 drafters. Not a large flight this year. A good proportion of those definitely won't make it to next year. You want another 80 or 90 color whites?
Of course not.
The parties are nice, Gavin, but understand what you are. This is the flip side of your first purpose. Even if you don't believe the prism is Orholam's gift to mankind, they do. The minutes each drafter spends with you being freed are the holiest moments of her life. You can take that away, but it would be the worst thing you could do. I, for one, can forgive you much, but I'd never forgive you that.
That stung.
Now, tell me how you dropped off Karis and Tyria, killed a Geist, and brought back a son, all within a few days. The trip alone should have taken you 2 weeks.
Well, that was quick. He'd known she would learn of the Skimmer and the Condor as soon as he'd shown Karis, but he hadn't been able to stop himself. Maybe he was impulsive. So he told her about the Skimmer and the Condor.
That would be something to see, Gavin, flying! And the speed! I suppose you'll want to go back to Garriston the same way.
Yes, and I'm taking Kip with me.
Good! It will be good for you to learn about a father's love.
Because I sure as the Evernight didn't learn about that from my own father.
Then Gavin realized that was exactly what she meant, and he bristled. But there was no point fighting over his father again.
So what was the second time?
Second time?
The second time you saw the green flash. The second time Orholam winked.
I look forward to the day when I tell you that, my Lord Prism. But that day is not today. When you return, we need to talk about Kip's testing.
You noticed the war crystals. I thought I stopped it in time.
Old, yes. Addled, not yet.
You want to hear me admit it? Kip nearly broke the test. Like Dazen did.
Or worse, passed it.
Karis knew she was even deeper in trouble than she'd feared within 5 minutes of being captured. King Haradol's mirror men walked her at gunpoint over to a wagon. They didn't bind her hands, which she thought was curious, and gave her a momentary hope. Then the mirrorman handed her off to half a dozen drafters, all women. Two mirrormen stayed, their pistols leveled at her head, barely blinking. The women, two reds, a green, a blue, and a super, stripped her naked and searched her and her clothes, quickly finding her eye caps. The two mirrormen barely even glanced at her body, and though men around the camp turned to see whatever they could between all the drafters surrounding her, there wasn't a single ribald comment.
Disciplined.
Crossing her arms over her breasts, Karis looked down, feigning embarrassment. Well, maybe not completely feigning.
Eyes up!
Karis looked up. They wanted to see her eyes, so they would know as soon as she tried to draft.
Smart, too. Damn it, twice.
In rapid order, they went through all her clothing, scrunching every seam to look for hidden pockets. Then they went through her bag, one carefully cataloging all the items in a codex. After they'd found everything, Karis hoped that they'd give her back her clothes. No such luck. Instead, they opened the door of the wagon and threw a violet dress and shift inside.
Get in!
Karis got in. The inside of the wagon was fairly spacious. There was a pallet to sleep on, a chamber pot, a cup of water, several blankets and pillows, all violet, the deepest into the blue spectrum they could find, and from the noxious smell, all freshly painted. The windows were fitted with bars and violet glass, draped on the outside with violet cloth. Apparently, they were taking her drafting seriously, and from their study of her eyes and the mag torches, they knew she could draft green and red. Rather than risk a color that was between her colors, they'd pick the one farthest to the end of the spectrum that she didn't draft. It was a strange kindness. They could have just blindfolded her, of course, but blindfold slip. But most captors would have painted the wagon black and made her live in darkness. This was just as effective, but a lot more work. If a drafter couldn't see her color or didn't have lenses in white light, she couldn't draft. Karis was about as close to helpless as she got. She hated the feeling with a passion. She threw on the slip and the shapeless violet dress and immediately scratched the paint. It had been heat-dried by a subred. She would be able to chip it eventually, but with the only light coming in through the violet curtains and violet glass, it wasn't going to matter anyway. Still, she tried. She couldn't help herself. Under the layer of violet paint was a layer of black. Under that, the wood was a dark mahogany.
No luck.
That night, after she was fed a hunk of black bread and given water in a blackened iron cup, two drafters came in, their skin already full of red and blue luxen, respectively. Behind them came, of all things, a tailor. She was a tiny woman who barely came up to Karis's shoulder. She took Karis's measurements rapidly, never writing them down, just committing them to memory. Then she stared at Karis's body for a long time, studying her like a farmer studying a rocky side hill that he needed to plow. She double-checked her measurement of Karis's hips, and then left without a word. Over the next 5 days, Karis learned little. The shadowy figures of horsemen, maybe mirror men, sometimes passed close enough to her covered windows for her to see their silhouettes. If they spoke, though, she could never make out the words. At night, she was given food in a blackened iron bowl with a blackened iron spoon and black bread and water, never wine. Damn them, they even thought of the red of wine. A mirrorman accompanied by a drafter took her chamber pot, bowl, spoon, and cup each night after sunset. When she kept the spoon one night, hiding it under a pillow, they didn't say a word. Neither did they give her water the next day. When she surrendered the spoon, she was given water again. The boredom was the worst. There were only so many push-ups you could do in a day, and anything more strenuous was impossible. There were no musical instruments, no books, and certainly no weapons or drafting to practice. On the sixth night, two blues came in.
Choose a position that's comfortable.
Kara sat on her little pallet, hands folded in her lap, ankles crossed, and they bound her arms and legs in about 5 times the amount of luxin necessary. Then they put violet spectacles over her eyes and left. King Haradil entered the wagon, carrying a folding camp chair. He wore a loose black shirt over his shirt, which Karis could barely see, and voluminous black pants over his pants. Karis understood being careful around her, but this was ridiculous. The king settled into the camp chair. He stared at her wordlessly for a moment.
I don't suppose you remember me. I met you once, before the war. Of course, I was just a boy, 3 years younger than you. And you were already head over heels for... Well, one of the Guile boys, I can't remember which. Maybe you can't either. There seemed to be some confusion for a time, wasn't there?
You're a real charmer, aren't you?
You might be surprised. I always thought you were a beautiful girl, but the stories of you took on a life of their own. A tragic love triangle between the two most powerful men in the world sort of demands a beautiful girl, doesn't it? I mean, otherwise, why would two men tear the world apart? For her insights about history? Her witty repartee? No! You were a pretty girl, made beautiful by the bard's need to make some sense of what you wrought. Oh, don't get me wrong. I was so in love with you it kept me up at night. You were my first, great, unrequited love.
I'm sure you've had many.
Or do women pretend to find you attractive now that you're king?
The shrewish tongue was somehow omitted from the panegyrics. Or is that a new addition?
I feel a bit freer to speak my mind these days. I already destroyed the world. What's one man's ego?
Karis, I was on my way to pay you a compliment before you made us descend into this unpleasantness.
Oh, dear. Please do go on, then. There's nothing that would mean more to me than to hear praises from the Butcher of Recton.
I'm sorry you had to see that, Karis. I hope you know I took no joy in what I ordered here. But I also hope you understand that that small monstrosity will forestall larger ones in the future. You're familiar with the manuscript called The Counselor to Kings?
Yes. Loathsome advice and cruelty that not even he had the stomach to countenance when he himself ruled. The counselor asked whether it would be better for a ruler to be loved or feared. Both was best, he decided. But if a ruler had to choose, he should always choose to be feared.
Well, his advice was good. He was simply personally weak. I don't hold that against him. The fact is, Karis, when kings aren't feared, they end up having to instill fear eventually, at grievous prices. That's what happened at Rue. That's what happened at Garriston. Those men you loved, or at least bedded, learned the lesson eventually, but because they learned it late, what they had to do was far worse than destroying one little village. So tell me, how can you hold the death of 1,000 against me, but not the death of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, against them?
Karis hadn't been allowed to see the royal steps at Rue, stained with the blood and shit of hundreds, murdered coldly one at a time, and thrown down the steps to the gaping, horrified crowds below. She'd been kept from going to Garriston even after the war, where tens of thousands, they didn't even know how many, had perished in the Red Luxon fires of the besieged city. That was Gavin's and Dazen's doing. Somehow it had never seemed possible that men she knew so well would have done such things. Men she thought she knew so well.
The people of this land are my army. I am no mere satrap, no guardian of some other man's land. I am king! These people belong to me. To kill 1,000 of my own was to cut a chunk of my own flesh. But cancers have to be cut out. I am this land. My people work this land and bring forth crops at my good pleasure. I protect them and provide for them, and they in turn must render to me of their crops and of their sons. Those who would not are rebels, traitors, thieves, and heretics, apostates. They defy the holy compact. To defy me is to defy the God's order. I had to do this because my father wouldn't. If he had hanged 6 mayors when they first defied him and refused to send levies, that 1,000 would be alive now. He was weak, and he wanted to be loved. No one may acknowledge it during my life, but killing that 1,000 in Recton, I saved many more. That is what it is to be a king.
You're awfully passionate in your defense of decapitating babies and stacking their heads.
Karis, you're making me understand why men beat their wives. By making the display so awful, I ensured it would be seared into every mind that saw it. Do you think the dead care what happened to their bodies? Better that their example save the living than that I bury them in a hole and my descendants have to kill their descendants. That monument will stay for 12 generations. That is the legacy I will leave to my children's children. A secure rule, without the need to commit such massacres themselves. And the reason I tell you, Karis, is that I had hoped you, of all people, might understand. You're a woman now, not some frightened little girl surrounded by great men. You're a woman who's seen great men and terrible deeds. I had hoped you might understand the burdens of greatness, at least a little. Perhaps I give you too much credit.
Karis was trembling with rage, and maybe a little fear. There was a sick logic to everything he said, but she had seen the bodies, the blood, the piled up heads.
Well, as I wanted to say earlier, you were a very pretty girl, but only pretty despite the tales. But you, to my great delight and surprise, are one of the few women I have ever seen who's gotten more beautiful as you've aged. You look better at 30 than you did at 20, and I wouldn't be surprised if you look better at 40 than you do now. Of course, I'm not sure it helps that you haven't squeezed 6 or 10 brats out of your crotch. Most pretty girls do manage to find a husband before they get so old, but let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. Oh, yours is indeed a face to inspire poets. This, however...
He gestured to her vaguely. She wasn't sure what he meant.
This must change. You have shoulders like a man.
The bastard. How did he know how much she hated her shoulders? Whenever the fashions were such that she could hide her shoulders, they showed off her upper arms, or vice versa. And he'd said exactly what she said to herself, at least once a week.
I have shoulders like a man.
Your ass looks like a 10-year-old boy's. Well, maybe it's that dress. We'll hope so. And your breasts. Your poor, magnificent breasts. Where have they gone? They were bigger when you were 15. Your training ends now. I'll allow you to resume dancing and riding when you no longer resemble a starved, dark forest pygmy.
I won't be here that long.
Oh, Karis, my dear. I've waited for you for 15 years. And whether or not you know it, you've been waiting for me, too. You and I don't settle for second best. Why else would you still be unmarried? So we can wait a few months. I'll come to visit you when your dress is done. Oh, and I've noticed you've nothing in here to entertain you. It must get boring. It's good for a woman to excel in the pleasant arts. I'll have my mother's santria brought in for you. That's what you play, isn't it?
Hardle smiled and went out. The worst part of it was that Karis did feel thankful. A little. The bastard. Kip and Liv went straight to the blackguards watching the lift.
We need to see the prism.
Who are you? Oh, are you the prism's bastard? nephew?
Yes, I'm his bastard. We need to see him. Now.
The blackguard looked over at his compatriot, a man just as muscular, but toweringly tall.
We've had no orders on how the prison wants his nephew treated.
He just went to sleep not 20 minutes ago, after being up all night.
It's an emergency.
They seemed unmoved. A little of who the hell is this girl creeping into their faces.
Someone just tried to kill me.
Stop! Get the commander.
He took third watch last night.
Stop!
All right, I'm going.
Stump left, and the taller blackguard turned and rapped on the door. The woman who opened the door was pretty, with the unsettlingly pale skin and red hair of a blood forester. She was fully dressed and alert, despite the early hour, and the darkness of the chamber behind her.
Marissa, so good to see you again.
The slave appeared none too pleased to see Liv. Kip wondered why Liv had used the slave's name then. He thought you were only supposed to do that with slaves with whom you were friendly. A moment later, all the windows banged open, and light streamed in from all sides, nearly blinding everyone.
That's brilliant magic! Look at that, Kip!
Liv pointed at a dark, purplish-black strip of glass around the glass walls that encircled the whole chamber.
What are you... Are you forgetting why we're here?
Oh, sorry.
Marissa. Copy, please.
First closet, third from the left.
Copy's in the closet? What the hell? Who puts Copy... And why aren't you serving me?
The door closed behind her.
And where's my favorite shirt? Closet. Damn it, woman.
Clearly a morning person.
This had better be important.
Gavin threw off his covers and walked toward the closet. He wasn't wearing anything. Kip had seen Gavin's forearms, with hemp ropes for muscles, and he'd known his father was lean. But seeing his whole body was half awe-inspiring and half a slap in the face. Kip's shoulders were as broad as Gavin's, and his arms were probably as big around as Gavin's, but even now, not after exertion, not filled from hard labor, but now after sleeping, Gavin's body was one smooth, curving muscle meeting another, over and over, without an ounce of softness anywhere. Apparently, sculling and skimming around the entirety of the seven satrapies did that to a man.
How did I come from this?
Next to him, Kip grew aware of Liv, staring, open-mouthed. She didn't avert her eyes, even as Gavin had to rummage through the closet.
Liv?
What? He's the prism. It's practically my religious duty to give him my full attention.
Anna, staring is rude.
Liv blushed harder and sank into herself, horrified.
Her name is Liv.
I know her name. Now what is it?
Gavin pulled on a dazzling white silk shirt with gold piping. The door opened behind Kip, and Marissia and Commander Iron Fist stepped into the room. Iron Fist stopped at the door, while Marissia brought in a tray with a silver service on it and three cups. She poured a dark, creamy, steaming brew into one cup and handed it to Gavin, whose pants and sleeves were still unlaced.
Commander? Kip?
Gavin motioned to the other cups.
I think Liv is quite alert enough already.
Liv looked like she wanted to fall through the floor. Kip grinned. Iron Fist helped himself to the copi while Marissia took over dressing Gavin. Kip picked up a cup too, but as he picked up the carafe, his hand started shaking so badly he couldn't even try to fill his cup.
Someone tried to throw me off the balcony.
It was like the words made it real. One moment ago, he'd been joking with Liv, thinking about how unlike his father he was, and grinning when Liv got embarrassed. Now, the reality of how close he'd come to getting thrown to his death came crashing in on him. He could see himself falling, twisting, helpless, like in an awful dream, and then his body bursting like a juicy grape. And who would have suspected anything? The woman could have slipped into his room, thrown him off the balcony, and then simply left. Even if they'd figured out who was on the floor at the time, who would expect a big woman as an assassin? People would have thought Kip had broken after his testing and jumped. No one would have known. And who would have cared? Kip felt a great, gnawing emptiness in his chest. He'd never been part of anything. Even back in Recton, he hadn't belonged. Too fat and awkward for Issa, too smart to feel a connection to Sanson, who seemed a whisker away from simple, relentlessly mocked by Ram, too young for Liv. He'd thought that being part of the Chromeria would make him be part of something for the first time in his life. He was going to be different here, too. He would be different and alone, no matter where he went. Poor Holum. Why had he even stopped that woman from throwing him over? 2 moments of terror, sure, and a mess of exploded Kip on the rocks, but the terror would end. Everything would end. And the sea would wash away the mess.
Make the words, Kip!
So, Kip told them everything. Liv stared woodenly at the floor when he told of her leaving, after he told her that he thought her father was dead.
General Danavis has been living in some backwater village all this time? Sorry, I knew we had a Danavis at the Chromeria, but I didn't think you were related.
I wouldn't be surprised if he did get away. The General's always a wily bastard, and I mean that in the best possible way.
Liv grinned, weakly and briefly. Kip told them the rest of it. After he finished, Gavin and Iron Fist shared a look.
The broken eye?
Impossible to know. Of course, that's the point.
The what?
My magisters told us that was a myth.
Your magisters are partly right. The Order of the Broken Eye is a reputed guild of assassins. They specialize in killing drafters. They've been rooted out and destroyed on at least 3 separate occasions, if not more. No satrap or satrapa enjoys losing drafters who've cost them so much before the end of their natural span. We believe that each time the order is reformed, it's been without any connection to any of the previous orders.
To put it plainly, some thug rounds up a few more thugs, hoping to make a lot of money from backstabbing a few drafters, and they name themselves the Order of the Broken Eye, so they can demand hefty payments. It's pure pretense.
How do you know?
Because if they were real, they'd be better at their job.
Kip scowled. His assassin had been pretty good.
It's not to say they're all equally incompetent, Kip. That's the whole point. We shouldn't even have brought it up. It doesn't get us any closer to the real problem. Whether or not the order is real, someone sent an assassin to kill you. You haven't been here long enough to make any enemies, so it's clearly an enemy of mine. There's only one thing for us to do.
What?
We run away.
What?
Meet me at the docks in an hour. Liv, that means you too. You'll be Kip's tutor. We're going to Garriston.
Garriston?
Pack quick. You never know where the Order is lurking.
Oh, thanks.
Pack? I don't even own anything!
The prisoner studied the dead man.
I'm going to kill you. I don't die easy.
The dead man was seated opposite Dazen, in his wall, knees folded, hands in his lap, his pose a mockery of Dazen's own. He glanced at the carefully woven rag in Dazen's lap.
Who would have thought? Gavin Guile, so patient, so quiet, so content doing women's work.
Dazen studied his handiwork. Woven of his own hair as tight as he could manage, with calm, cool blue flowing through his body, he wasn't even sure how long he'd spent on it. Weeks, maybe. It made almost a skullcap, a small bowl. He studied the shiny interior. Finding perhaps a flaw, he took a long but perfectly round fingernail and scraped it around his nose, over his forehead in methodical strokes, harvesting the accumulated skin, and more importantly, the precious oil with another fingernail. Dazen smeared the oil carefully onto the flaw. He was only going to get one chance. After years and years, he wasn't going to mess it up. With a steady hand and skin filled with blue, he gathered more oil and smeared it on the wall directly over the dead man's face.
This doesn't change anything, Gavin. No, not yet.
He stood and drafted a blade. He cut off a hank of his greasy hair. He scrubbed it against his dirty skin, getting it as foul as possible.
You don't need to do this. It's madness. It's victory!
Dazen drew the blue Luxon blade smoothly across his chest.
If you're going to kill yourself, the wrist or the neck would work better.
Dazen ignored him. With dirty fingers, he pulled the cut open and tucked the putrid mass of hair and dirt under the flap of skin. He put a hand to his chest and pressed on the wound, holding it closed, slowing the bleeding. In a few sleeps, the cell would be cleansed with Dazen's weekly bath. Soon thereafter, depending on how well he had planned and guessed, he would either escape or be dead. As long as he held the blue, he found that he didn't care much, one way or the other. Liv stuffed clothing into a bag.
I came back here this morning to apologize.
Huh?
The clothes in her hand were some lacy undergarments. Distracting.
You know, when you were busy trying to get killed.
Apology accepted?
What was she apologizing for? He shifted the weight on the pack that Commander Iron Fist had given him before disappearing. Apparently, it had taken Iron Fist almost no time to gather some spare clothing, a water skin, tools, and even a short sword for Kip. Kip still hadn't figured out how to get the pack to sit comfortably on his shoulders, though. He'd come to Liv's room to help her pack, but she wasn't making things any easier. He glanced at the short pants again.
They're just underclothes, Kip.
They're see-through.
How could such a small bit of cloth actually fit a person inside it? Liv looked down and colored a little, but played it off. She tossed the short pants to Kip, who caught them instinctively, and instantly felt awkward.
Would you check if those are clean?
Kip's eyebrows shot off his face and stuck somewhere three floors up.
I'm teasing! I just moved and they gave me all new clothes. Everything here is new.
Except my gullibility, apparently.
Oh, you're great, Kip. It's like torturing the little brother I never had.
Oh, the little brother comparison. Just what every man wants to hear from a beautiful woman. I've just been castrated. So, would I feel more or less awkward holding my sister's underclothes?
Would these be better or worse?
She held up some black lace that looked like little more than two strings tied together artistically. Then she held them up to her hips and cocked a saucy eyebrow at him.
I think I need to sit down.
He backed up toward a chair and instantly bumped into someone.
Watch it! You don't want to run into someone with that little sword sticking out.
Kip was too mortified for words. Little? Liv saw the look on his face. Turning around, Kip felt Iron Fist's firm hand guiding his pack away from him, so he didn't stab him with the scabbarded short sword on top of it. Relief flooded Kip, until he saw Iron Fist glance down at the sheer short pants in his hands.
You need me to find some in your size? Oliviana, you're done packing? It's because we're leaving in 5 minutes.
Liv popped off the bed and began rummaging through her things at great speed. Iron Fist let a small, satisfied smirk steal over his face briefly. Then he dropped another pack next to Kip's and walked out.
Move it, boy genius! If you haven't figured out the straps on your pack before I get back...
He didn't complete the threat. He didn't need to. Soon they were striding onto the docks together. Despite his threats, Iron Fist had helped them with some settling of the packs. Mostly, that meant moving things from Liv's pack to Kip's. Kip asked the silent question, why are you making me carry her stuff?
It's more complicated to be a girl. You got a problem?
Kip shook his head quickly. As they walked down the docks, past fishermen unloading catches, apprentices of various trades running back and forth, loiterers, merchant women arguing with captains about prices for goods or transit, basically all the normal business of the day, many people stopped whatever they were doing for a few moments. It wasn't to watch Kip, of course. It was to watch Commander Iron Fist. The man was big and imposing and handsome, and he strode with a total self-awareness. But it wasn't his sheer physical presence that got him so much attention. He was, Kip realized, famous. As Kip turned to see the faces looking at Commander Iron Fist, he could see Gavin walking onto the docks. And if for Commander Iron Fist, business slowed, for the Prism, it stopped entirely. Gavin walked through, smiling and nodding to people automatically, but they treated him like he was nearly a god. No one tried to touch Gavin himself, but not a few brushed his cloak as it floated past.
What am I doing with these people?
A week ago, Kip had been cleaning puke off his mother's face and hair while she lay passed out from another binge, in their hovel, with a dirt floor. No one in their backwater town had paid him the least mind. The addict's boy, that's all he was. Maybe the fat boy.
I don't belong here. I've never belonged anywhere. Mother told me I ruined her life, and now I'm ruining Gavin's.
Kip couldn't help but think of his mother's last words, and the promise he made as she was dying. He'd sworn to avenge her, and he'd hardly done anything to keep that oath. They said Orholm himself watched over oaths. Kip hadn't learned anything, and now they were going back.
Hey, why so glum?
Liv laid a hand on his arm, which tingled from the contact. They'd stopped at an empty place on the dock, down a ramp low to the water, and Commander Iron Fist was drafting a Luxon platform onto the water, the first building block of a skull.
I don't know. Thinking about Tyria makes me think about... You know. I hope your father's well, Liv. He was always good to me. He was the only one.
Yet even with Master Danavis, there had been a wall, a point past which he wouldn't let Kip in. Was it just because of his own history that he had to keep secret? Or was there something deeper? Something wrong with Kip?
Kip, it's going to work out.
He looked over at her and couldn't help but smile. Orholm had never made a more beautiful woman. Liv could shame the sunset with her radiance. He fell into her dimples, hopeless. He looked away.
Little brother, fun to joke around with, but not a man.
The despair threatened to choke him completely.
Thanks. Iron Fist, can I have a snack?
Yes, of course.
Great.
When we get back.
Hey.
Now shut it. The Lord Prism is here.
All eyes still on him, Gavin stopped in front of Commander Iron Fist. He looked at Iron Fist's pack. Neither said anything for a long time.
You can't come. I'm not taking a bodyguard.
I'm not coming with you.
Then get off my skull.
I'm coming with Kip. He's a member of the Prism's family, and he's entitled to protection.
You're the commander of the Blackguard. You can't possibly...
I can do what I deem appropriate to discharge the duties of the Blackguard. None may interfere with that. None.
You are a wily bastard, aren't you?
It's why I'm still here. And quite possibly why you are too.
You win, but let me remind you of your oaths.
Iron Fist looked offended.
You'll understand soon. Everyone load up.